Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Keller, your host. So happy to be here with you on a Friday afternoon. Maybe it's a Friday evening where you are, or even a Saturday morning, whatever time of day it is or whatever day it is. We're just happy that you're here. We always try to give you a little something special on a Friday, maybe a little something fun if we can do that. And we've just got two great guests for you today. Second hour, do you ever kind of have certain things that you might feel ashamed of as a Catholic? Like somebody will say the Inquisition or somebody will say the Crusades. Well, Steve Weidenkopf, one of our favorite historians, maybe our favorite historian, will be here the second hour to talk about the Crusades, and we'll work through some of that. What actually happened? And was it as unchristian as it's often portrayed? We'll talk to Steve about that, and you are very welcome that hour. In this hour, one of the speakers at our conference, by the way, in many places in the world, we're getting less and less Christianity. That is, the world's kind of de-Christianizing. So how's the Christian supposed to think about morality, about right and wrong, in a world that no longer uses a Christian moral standard? And this hour, we're going to consider doing the hard work of moral theology in a post-Christian world, and we have just the perfect guest to help us do that. And just buckle in, because I got to read you her whole bio. No, she's got a great educational background here. So Simone Riscala is our guest. Simone is the Director of Program Growth for Endow Groups. She's also an Institute of Catholic Theology Fellow, a Witherspoon John Jay Institute Fellow, and an Acton Institute Fellow. She has studied at the St. Albert the Great Center for Scholastic Studies. That's in Italy, at the Phoenix Institute for International Theological Phoenix Institute at the International Theological Institute, that's in Austria, and she's studied in Krakow. She's got a degree in theological studies, her graduate degree in with an emphasis in systematic theology from Christendom Theology. I got to take a nap. Christendom College. Oh, I'm so tired from reading all that. Simone Riscala, thanks for being with us.
Sorry, thanks so much. It's all made up.
I don't even believe that at all. But you know what? I didn't even get to the biggest honor of all in all this work that you have done in understanding Catholic theology and applying it to the modern world, which seems to me the emphasis of your work. Probably the biggest thing is you're going to be one of the featured speakers a month from now at the Catholic Answers Conference. Wouldn't you say that's one of the biggest honors?
I wholeheartedly agree. It is a level of unalloyed joy I have yet to experience. And by the way, I love Steve Weidenkopf. He was my professor in graduate school. So
I wondered about that, because he's at the graduate school at Christendom College. He's a great one, Steve Weidenkopf.
He's amazing. I wouldn't have been able to teach church history to seniors if it hadn't been for him. He not only taught me good content, he taught me how to teach it. And that was awesome.
And when you say to seniors, you don't mean people my age, you mean high school seniors.
High school seniors, yes,
absolutely.
Misery.
All right, I got about a million questions I want to ask you. We do have to talk about what Endow does. I just love what you do with Endow. We're going to talk a little bit about the conference talk and all that, but let's get right into the topic if we can. And I want to invite people to call. If you have questions about doing moral theology, 888-318-7884. You could be advanced. You could be beginner level. Anyone is welcome to call 888-318-7884. It does seem that, at least it seems to me, that as the world kind of lets Christianity recede for the time being, it becomes more morally confused. So what do we have to offer to help answer that confusion?
Yeah, I mean, the most basic thing is we have the truth to offer. And at least my experience in teaching, I mean, I've taught moral theology to adults as well in various capacities. But, you know, moral theology is not taught. It's just, there's like basic moral theological principles that I think every Catholic should know, but it's just not taught.
I noticed that when the pandemic came around, it seemed like a lot of having to go back to first principles and basic terms. This happens when we talk about all the moral issues of, certainly we have to do it every time we talk about abortion, with anybody on the air. You just feel this sense of, we're not starting at a level where folks have been taught their basic moral theology.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, the thing that I wanted to hone into my students, besides the fact that, yes, you will forget some of the stuff you learned in high school, but what I don't want you to forget is that you can come to the church to learn. That when you do have a question, the church has an answer, and not just any answer, it has like a deeply profound, well-crafted, well-developed theology that's available to you. So just come back and know that the answers are there. But in terms of moral theology, you know, the big takeaway is that, you know, the ends don't justify the means. You know, never do evil for no matter how good the reason might be. You know, just never do evil. And that's a very basic principle, but even something as simple as that isn't taught frequently.
No, you know? In August, when you say something like that to me in August, it's very tempting to start talking about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Yes. But I will prescind from that for now. But so let's get into that. So it's a post-Christian era, and I think that becomes just de facto kind of relativist and practical, I suppose, just purely practical, utilitarian kind of practical, without the Christian influence. Is that the sense that you get of how people think about morals?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, there's so many ways to approach it, and I kind of always like to approach things from an evangelical bent, right? So there's, and I'm just going to use my students as like the target, right? Because I think we're all high school students at heart, in a sense, right? If it's interesting for them, it's interesting for everybody. But first, there's like the human experience of living in this culture that doesn't, you know, that it's the my truth world, right? So I'm just speaking my truth, right? And so that experience of, hold on, there is a level of subjectivity to human experience, but like C.S. Lewis says so well in Mere Christianity, you know, you can be a relativist. I mean, I'm paraphrasing Lewis. You can be a relativist all you want, but the second someone steals your orange, you know, you're suddenly an absolutist, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he was Irish, and orange was very valuable to him, but.
Yeah. Well, he's so charming in the way he teaches. Right. But, yeah. But the, you know, you can't, you know, but you see, hear absurd things. And I remember being in university and, you know, arguing with relativists all the time, and, you know, especially feminist relativists. I said, well, my family's from Egypt. Female circumcision is part of the culture. As a feminist in America, what do you think of that? And they'd be like, well, I guess if it's part of the culture.
Oh, wow. That's, I hear it all the time, but when you hear it said out loud again, it always hurts kind of. Like, you would allow women to be treated this way because what? Because of some kind of false respect for a culture?
Right. I mean, it's just, look them in the eye contact saying, you really, in your heart of hearts, truly can say that, so that your supposed American feminist ideals only apply to American women, that you don't, on some level, this isn't shocking to you or disturbing. So there's that personal experience of trying to grab at the heart that, what do you have to say about the injustices that happened to you? Can you really say that at the end of the day, you don't think that there's a right and a wrong, and that you deserve and merit justice? And I think the other approach with moral theology is just, again, I just don't know. I love talking about anthropology and the powers of the human soul and the virtues that perfect the soul, because this is our humanity. This is who we are. Every Catholic should know these things. And there's a lot of freedom in knowing that. There's a lot of freedom in knowing you're a thinking being who has free will, that has emotions that are supposed to guide and direct what reason dictates. And this is how you make choices. You know, I mean, that's amazing.
It seems like such an appealing and empowering message too. I mean, well, it is appealing and empowering, but somehow it is, you know, like, making choices is the thing that you have to do. Like, you can't be a human being and not make choices about what's reasonable and what's responsible, as they say. You know, you got to make those moral choices, those intellectual choices. And yet when we say, okay, well, that would mean that, you know, just to take the example I already gave, that abortion is wrong, that I choose to accept that reality, that it's wrong always, then all of a sudden you're not, you're a fascist for having that thought, or semi-fascist.
Yeah. I mean, right. And so how do we have a dialogue when the highest value is convenience, right, or personal autonomy, instead of the fact that there is a way in which we belong to each other and there is this objective moral order that perhaps we might want to step into that. So I think again with my students, if I could get them to accept, like actually reflect and accept that things have happened in their life that they're not okay with, okay, then I've taken them out of the relativistic context. If I can educate them on what it means to be a human being and that we're not neutral, right? That no matter what the Enlightenment thinkers thought freedom was, it's not a freedom of license. Like our freedom is ordered to the good, to the true, to the beautiful. Then we could actually have a lot of fun with like moral theology, right? Then we could go into moral theology and they can suspend their disbelief, whatever the culture is saying, and say, okay, let's just say this is true. My experience says it's true. And my humanity seems to resonate with what the church teaches about what it means to be human. Okay, let's talk about the principle of double effect. Let's talk about the sources of morality. Let's talk about how we judge moral actions, you know? And that's fun.
Yes. Yeah, it is fun. I entirely agree with you. And it also leads often to liberties that we might not have known that we had. It doesn't just lead to more and more restrictions. The better you are as a moral theologian doesn't mean the stricter or meaner you are as a moral theologian. Much of the church's teaching is very, very liberating.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely is totally liberating because boundaries are liberating, right? We can talk about that somehow in psychotherapy, that boundaries are the way to personal freedom. But when it comes to morality, we're just like, oh, I don't know about that.
I haven't made it that far in my psychotherapy. I'm way behind you on that, Simone. Miss Riz is here. Simone Rizcala is our guest. We're talking about moral theology. We'd love it. If you have a question, give us a call. 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. Oh, look at that. The lines are already starting to fill up. So do dial 888-31-TRUTH. We'll be right back with more with Simone Rizcala on moral theology in a post-Christian world, right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Check out EWTN's official YouTube channel.
Just follow the link on our homepage at EWTN.com or go to YouTube.com/EWTN.
Watch EWTN's live shows or today's homily from the Daily Mass.
Click the upload button to see our most recent clips.
You can also find all of EWTN YouTube content by clicking the playlist button.
It's all on the official EWTN YouTube channel at YouTube.com/EWTN.
Visit today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Simone Rizcala is our guest, and she will also be our guest at the Catholic Answers annual conference. The entire conference is dedicated to considering the person of Jesus Christ in the Eucharist, and her talk is called The Body of Christ, Eucharistic and Ecclesial Communion in the Life of the Church. You really should sign up and just come just for this talk. But there's tons more talks. We'll do the radio show a couple times. Maybe we'll, if I don't think we've asked her yet, but maybe we'll get Simone to be on the radio show with us when we do it. Just great speakers, a great group of people. You'll just have a great time. Some fantastic chant, both in the Mass and then also as a kind of entertainment one evening. So go over and check it out at CatholicAnswersConference.com. You'll get the special room rate of $169 a night, which in San Diego in September is a great room rate. CatholicAnswersConference.com. We'd love to see you there. And Simone, did I get it right? Your title? Sometimes I get them wrong. So, okay,
no,
that was it. Very good. A bunch of people have questions for you about moral theology. Shall we go to the phones? I'm going to take that as a yes. I don't know if I lost touch with Simone, but here we go. Maddie in Dayton, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio, asks this, Simone. Oh, no, Maddie's on the line. I don't, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Could someone hit line two for me? Maddie in Ohio. Go ahead. I thought it was just a question that was typed in. But go ahead, Maddie.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Very good. Thank you. I'm sorry. I didn't realize you were waiting there on the line. Go ahead with your question for Simone Rizcala.
All righty. I have a sibling. Let's just call them their confirmation name, Genesius. They are currently non-binary and also an atheist these days. Mm. And as a Catholic, I want to do what I can to help. But, you know,
yeah,
it's kind of hard, especially considering, you know, they don't even believe in God or anything, really.
Yeah. Genesius. So they're an actor type person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're basically you're asking, like, what do I do? How do I love this person? Well, I mean, I think the same is true for anybody that's kind of living outside of a Catholic worldview in terms of how they view themselves and their identity. And I think what I would do and have done with people in the past in those kind of situations is to repeat in a Holy Spirit motivated kind of way, right? You have to pray for the divine appointments so that the Spirit can kind of land when you have what are organic conversations, is to gently, again, the thing is never about the thing. So you don't want to attack the thing, but the bigger thing is that to propose in some way, in your own unique words, because you were born for such a time as this, to love this person, and to say, you're gonna have to reframe this in the way that makes sense for you in your relationship with this person. But that what you find so beautiful about the Catholic faith, about the Christian faith, is that identity is in simply this: that you belong to God, whether you believe in Him or not. Your freedom, your identity is that God loves you into being, and you, no matter what you may or may not see yourself as, identify as, no matter how much money you make, how rich you are, successful, whatever, however popular you are, whether you're sick, whether you're healthy, like there's nothing more unconditionally loving than a church that teaches that everybody is loved into being by God, and their identity comes from that, and their dignity comes from that and that alone. And that is pretty radical, and it's very wild, and it's very little understood in the church.
What do you think, Maddie?
I think that could be helpful. It's just, you know, being the little sister, sometimes that could be a little hard to confront them. You know how that goes.
Oh, yeah. And I don't even think you have to think about it as a confrontation. I think you just have to keep building your relationship of trust, you know, and find opportunities to communicate that. And maybe it's not about your sister directly, but just that you're telling a story about someone else, or just, you know, I don't know the particularities, but I think you can definitely, first of all, you have to have hope and doing a lot of praying and fasting, right? Because God has a plan for your sibling. God has a plan for your sibling, and you're part of that plan. So if your starting point is already kind of hopeless, there's not much the Spirit can do to work with that. You know, you have to be confident that God is already after your sibling, already pursuing, and you just want to be as prayerful, as intelligent as possible, strategic, gentle as doves, wise as serpents, in how you approach conversations, if and when those conversations happen. But again, the relationship that you build, I mean, that has to be the primary thing, so that if and when they're ready, you're credible, and you can speak with a conviction and an authority that is believable.
Mm-hmm. Maddie, go ahead, Maddie. Did you have something you want to say?
I was just saying, I was listening, yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for the call. Please continue to call if we'd love to talk about this topic, how to love people and be convincing in sharing the good news with people, even our older siblings. So you're always welcome here. The number here is 888-318-7884. Simone, just before I go to the next caller, because the word non-binary is used there, it does strike me that not just in moral matters, but in matters of basic physical reality, we have this attitude that you talked about, my truth, before, that my truth is the most important thing, and the truth or a truth about me is is oppressive somehow to my truth.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it really is where the rubber meets the road, right? Like we didn't create ourselves. We didn't create ourselves. And even for those of us in the church who understand that and believe that and embrace that, we're still in our spiritual life, which is always a struggle, doing a tug of war with the person that we think we want to be, or the person we think we are, and the person we actually are.
You know?
So again, when it comes to issues of gender, that's like very, very dramatic. But the truth is, everybody can relate to the fact that there's a self-knowledge and a reality and aspects of myself that I don't want to look at. And maybe even the beautiful things that I don't want to accept because I want those other beautiful things, right?
Yes.
So I think on that very fundamental level of the human heart, that's always kind of where the battlefield is, you know? And at some point, we're going to lose to God. So we got to maybe.
The faster, the better. The faster, the better.
The faster, the better.
Let's go to Minnesota. Jonathan in Minnesota is watching on YouTube. Jonathan, you have a moral theology question for Simone Rizcala? Do we have Jonathan? Go ahead, Jonathan. Sorry.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I really appreciate it. And I would attribute my conversion to Catholicism and my wife's in part to Catholic Answers.
Oh, praise God. Thank you for sharing that with us, Jonathan. Thank you very much.
So I have a question on how should Catholics approach laws that increase restrictions on abortion, but not outright ban them if that's not an option?
Yeah. I mean, take what we can get, you know. I mean, having restrictions on abortion is better than not having restrictions on abortion. And then we keep working toward, you know, total ban.
What's the holdup for you, Jonathan, about that? Does that seem like you're voting for abortion if you do that?
Yeah. So an example would be, a state that has it legal until the second trimester. If an option might be keeping it legal until the first trimester and restricting it, doesn't that sort of still imply that it's okay through the first trimester? But if that's the best that we can get, you know, is that, I guess, how would that line up with church teaching?
Yeah, I mean, of course, church teaching prohibits entirely, murder, which abortion is. But in terms of like how we prudentially navigate political waters in the public square, right? That's where we have to start taking steps, right? Like we'll take overturning Roe v. Wade doesn't mean that every state is now going to ban abortion, but we'll take it, right? So
right.
Building blocks, right? We have to continue working for justice so that we can at some point transition from justice to charity, right? While on a grassroots level in the church, working very charitably to make abortion not just illegal but unthinkable, right? Because again, like the conversion of hearts is at the end of the day, you know, politics is a reflection of culture, as Newhouse used to say, and culture is a reflection of faith and religion. So when I was in DC, I got super jaded pretty quickly. I'm like, this is going to take way too long to work in the political, and everybody, you know, Christians have legitimate vocations in politics, right? But I thought, you know what, I'd much rather form hearts and minds, especially the youth, so that the law, whether it's legal or not, becomes irrelevant in the life of the people that I can form to the true, the good, the beautiful. So I think in whatever your personal vocation is, whatever arena you're called to kind of influence and to work for the true, the good, the beautiful, follow it and find it. But for me, I thought I would much rather build a civilization of love on a grassroots level so that whether the law was for or against abortion, you know, it would be unthinkable for a woman to participate in that.
Jonathan, thanks. Boy, the line's really filled up, so I'm going to keep moving to try to get everybody on. I'm going to go to Sacramento, California. George is watching on YouTube in Sacramento, California. George, please go ahead with your question for our guest, Simone Rizcala.
Well, hello, you too. I just wanted to say thank you for your time, and it's always a pleasure calling on here. So I am in Catholic education, and I had a specific question that I was grappling with. And in reference to, or at least in the context of this post-Christian, you know, relativism that you mentioned or that you touched on, Simone, doesn't the, and please correct this, you know, presupposition or this assumption, doesn't the Catechism teach us that we ought to follow our conscience? And of course, we understand very well that consciousness, it could be damaged, it could be wrong. So how do we balance that, or how do we compensate that with the fact that we're called to live a non-relative, absolute moral life?
George, the music's playing, so we'll have to let Simone take that when we get back. Balancing conscience with morality, right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Can you defend the Church's teaching on the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist? Do you desire a deeper relationship with our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament? Join us September 22nd through 25th for the annual Catholic Answers Conference in San Diego. This year's theme is the Eucharist, I am with you always. Featuring all the Catholic Answers speakers and special guest Bishop Thomas Papracki, use promo code EARLY to save $50 when you register at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. George is on the line in Sacramento. Our guest is Simone Rizcala, and we're talking about doing moral theology in a post-Christian world. And George asks, well, the Catechism tells us to follow our conscience, but we're supposed to also have an absolute view that some things are right and some things are wrong. So how do you reconcile an absolutist morality with a teaching that says follow your conscience?
Yeah, I absolutely love that question. I love that question. Because conscience, which I'm just going to throw out, here's the teacher in me. I'm going to throw out a really easy definition of conscience. Conscience is the practical judgment of the intellect. So it's not a separate power of the human soul, but it's like your intellect activated to situations that you've done, situations that you're in the middle of doing, and situations that you're about to do. So that's when conscience gets activated. There's a practical element to it. So yes, the Catechism does say you are always bound to follow your conscience, right? But conscience, look at the word conscience, conscience, with knowledge, right? So that's why the Catechism also says that you have a duty to form your conscience, right? So as a Catholic, yes, you must follow your conscience, but you know, this is why Catholic Answers is so crucial. The more you know, the more you're culpable for. And if you know there's things that you should know that you don't know, that you're not learning because you don't want to form your conscience so you can get away with it, you're also culpable for that, right? So, you know, if you know where to go to form your conscience properly and you're like, you know what, I'm going to just skip those paragraphs in the Catechism, right? You're also culpable for that. And I'm thinking of my precious former student named Oliver, who, you know, he were taking moral theology. He's learning all this stuff. And he's like, Miss Riz, shouldn't I have just gone to public school? Because they're not learning any of this. And then I can get away with all sorts of stuff. You know, yeah. And it wouldn't be my fault. And I'm like, well, you're here now, buddy. So you are culpable for it. You know, so we have a duty to form our conscience. And I think one of the most amazing things about this whole following your conscience business is that, you know, we know what the moral law is, right? So if our conscience, you have to make a distinction, right? Conscience is the practical judgment of the intellect. If you're reducing conscience to how you feel about something, that's actually not your conscience. This is about what you know to be true, not what you feel that you know, but what you actually know. So you know the Ten Commandments, that should form your conscience. You should also know the different, you know, St. Thomas will talk about the various deformed consciences. And I think our personality types kind of help us understand, like, you know, where do we need more formation in our conscience? You know, if you're a sanguine personality type, you might be tempted to have what Thomas will call a lax conscience. Like, that's not that big a deal, right? If you're an introverted melancholic, maybe you're tempted to scrupulosity, which is another form of a deformed conscience, right? So you kind of have to, again, self-knowledge is so important, because then you can kind of know how to shape your soul to be correct.
George, does that help you?
Yes, that was great. Thank you so much.
I thought so too. As Simone, as you were giving that answer, I was thinking, Darren does a great job, but he's blowing it by not scheduling you more. I don't know what he's doing. And I'm sorry to, you know, pick on Darren on the air, but George, thanks very, very much.
The number's 888.
Yeah, great question. 888-318-7884. We're talking moral theology. Simone Riscala here to do that with us. Casey in Fresno, California, watching on YouTube. You are next, Casey. Go ahead with your question for Simone.
Hello. So my question was, how are Christians supposed to react to the death penalty used in the past, especially when the church has been involved with it, and when it's used now? How are we supposed to see that?
Are you talking about the Spanish Inquisition when you're talking about the death penalty?
Situations like that.
Well, Steve Weidenkopf, who's coming up the next hour, is perfect to talk about that. But I will say this, it was never the church herself that used the death penalty. It was the Spanish Inquisition in relationship with the state, right? So it was always the state that enacted the death penalty, not the church herself. Although the church, you know, was, you know, the Dominicans were inquisitors. So that's a partial answer to your question about the death. But the death penalty now is still, the question about the church and the death penalty now is not really a question of the church, because again, we don't put people to death. But if what you're really asking, and you can clarify this, is can we support the death penalty? Certainly, because it's part of the natural law to be able to defend yourself. Now, I know there's a lot of confusion with with Pope Francis and the whole death penalty thing. And Pope Benedict and John Paul II said very much so that, we must do everything we can possible to preserve life, right? But that doesn't exclude the possibility that in certain prudential judgments, we can support the death penalty. Now, I don't know if you or I are ever going to be in that decision to be a moral theologian and to determine, or to be in that position in government or the state that can say, like, okay, this person is a total threat, and we have, you know, right? That's not really our vocations. But in terms of a theological perspective, yes, we have to allow room for the fact that you can kill in self-defense. And that's what the state's doing when they use the death penalty. That's how they should be approaching the death penalty. That's not how it often is, but that's how it ought to be if you're going to have a state formed by Catholic moral teaching.
Yeah, today it's utterly confused on the state level. But Casey, satisfied?
Yeah, can I ask a quick follow-up question?
Please do. Go ahead.
Yeah, if the death penalty was permissible in the past, recent popes were not, like, they'd call it inadmissible and stuff like that. Why would it be more permissible? Why was it more permissible in the past versus now?
I wouldn't say that it's less, more or less permissible. The idea that for the sake of the common good, you would take a guilty person's life to protect the state, right? Let's just assume that the conditions are such that you can, with a clear moral conscience, take the life of somebody who proposes a serious threat to the common good. Let's just say that. It's not that it was more or less permissible then and now. It's just that now, and I think this is Pope Francis's language, because we have the technology to keep somebody alive without being a threat to the common good, we ought to exercise all of our technology to do everything possible to keep that person alive for the possibility of repentance, and because they're made in God's image and likeness and they're a creature made by God. So if we cannot endanger the common good in the state by keeping them alive, then we ought to do everything possible to keep them alive. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and in the past, okay. Was that just not possible, like imprisonment for them?
Well, I don't know what prison systems are like or technology and all of that, but I'm assuming so.
Thanks, Casey. I'm going to go to New York. Oh, New York City. John in New York City, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Go ahead with your question for Simone.
Yeah, I'm from upstate New York, so we always like the difference. Simone, thank you very much for taking the call. I need some advice from you. As of a month ago, I am now the theology teacher for the 10th, 11th, and 12th grade in a Catholic high school. I never taught before, at least not in that setting. And I've been given carte blanche to basically rewrite the curriculum. And one of the things I wanted to do was touch upon, obviously, the subject of moral theology. And I'm looking for resources and try to get me out of panic mode, because I have to do it within the next 2 weeks, you know, to
get this together. That is amazing. Oh, my gosh. I love it when I heard the word carte blanche, because now you can actually teach, right? You're not bound by a curriculum, some arbitrary unevangelizing curriculum or some random textbook. You can, like, choose your books, your curriculum. That's great.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have a 13-year relationship as a parent, and unfortunately, my two kids came to me recently and said, don't take the job. And I said, why? And they said, Dad, they're not going to listen to you. And you're going to get frustrated because you're an ex-law enforcement person. And I said, look, I handle some bad guys. I think I can handle a 16 and 17-year-old. And they said, no, you can't.
They're
in their 20s.
All right. Simone, you got any resource suggestions for John?
You're going to be awesome. And by the way, in my theology department was a former sheriff, and he had super street cred teaching theology to high schoolers. So you're going to be awesome. Shoot me. I'm going to give you some resources now, but also shoot me an email at My blog is Cultural Gypsy, and I'll send you all my good stuff, my practical stuff. But right off the top of my head, definitely C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. He also has a book called The Problem of Pain. He has chapters on hell and chapters on heaven that make excellent seminar discussions. And then, because what we don't want to do with our kids is to have them think that we don't want to make little Pelagian heretics, right? That you save yourself by all your moral coherence, right? But that the source of morality is loving someone and loving God, and morality is an expression of that. I really think you want to make sure that before you go into, like, here are the Ten Commandments, here are the Beatitudes, here are the most basic moral theological principles, you know, all those things that are pretty hard-hitting, especially like the hot button issues. You want to frame it for them under that the source of morality is loving someone. And so the text that I used in moral theology, which was the favorite text, was actually my guy, Joseph Ratzinger, short little book called What It Means to Be a Christian, 3 homilies. And it's just awesome. It's just awesome to do with high schools. I mean, they just loved it. They're like, who's this Ratzinger guy? He's like really good. I'm like, yeah, isn't he?
Isn't he? Yeah. Yeah. He went on to big things after this. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are my suggestions right off the top of my head.
And that brings us to the break, John. So I got to go to that break. Simone Riscala is our guest. We're talking about doing moral theology in a post-Christian world. Your questions welcome. 888-318-7884.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He was a Jesuit, a cardinal, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Robert Bellarmine is honored for his immense contributions to theology, including helping to draft two important catechisms that defended church teachings during the Protestant Revolt. Pope Clement VIII named Bellarmine a cardinal because, as the Pope put it, Bellarmine had not his equal for learning.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking moral theology with Simone Rizcala. Simone will be one of the speakers at our conference this year, our conference on the Eucharist. You can find out all about the conference at CatholicAnswersConference.com. But I'd like to you to find out about another thing. That is that Simone's day job is with Endow. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do at Endow? I'll go back to the calls in just a quick second here, but I would like people to know what you do at Endow and why it's worth being involved with.
Yeah, absolutely, Sai. So Endow stands for Educating on the Nature and Dignity of Women. That's a phrase that we got from John Paul II's 1988 apostolic letter, Mulieris Dignitatum, on the dignity and vocation of women. And so we call women together in 8 to 12 week study groups to study important church documents and the writings of the saints and female doctors of the church. So that's in a nutshell what Endow does. So if you always wanted to study, certain church documents of Vatican II, encyclicals of John Paul II, particularly the ones that confront the genius of women, the female saints and doctors of the church, we have 15 studies. We have studies on St. Wow. Thomas Aquinas. Yeah, it's awesome.
So give the web address where people can find it.
Yeah, endowgroups.org. So E-N-D-O-W, groups.org.
Check it out. You won't be sorry you did. But you know what, Simone, you told me also that you had a couple other things you wish you had mentioned to John before about resources for teaching high schoolers. I'm sorry I went right past that, but go ahead and finish your list.
No. Yeah, not at all. It just came to me during the break that if you're going to teach moral theology, to take a look at Benedict's Christmas encyclical Deus Caritas Est, God is Love, as well as John Paul II's Caritas in Veritate, which kind of goes through a lot of things. It's very dense, but it goes through some moral theological heresies of late. That
you're saying John Paul II wrote something that was dense? So
but the kids can handle it. They can handle it. Of course, there's good old fashioned catechism and the Summa. You can let them dip their toes in the Summa. They can do it.
Sure. Do it. Oh yes. Yeah. Yeah. But they might become enamored of it too. I mean, it could become a lifelong thing because it really. Yeah. I'm with you on that. Let's go to Grand Rapids, Michigan now. Tony, in Grand Rapids, listening on 98.3 FM. We're glad you're here, Tony. Go ahead with your question for Simone.
Thank you for doing what you guys are doing. And yes, Joseph Ratzinger rules.
Yes.
I'm a physician. Amen.
Well, not literally. Francis does now, but I got you.
Well, he does now, but yeah. But anyways, I'm a physician
I know what you mean.
Assistant. And I guess your comments earlier about feelings and knowledge kind of struck me as maybe part of the answer I'm trying to find. So it's very important to me when I speak that the people I talk to understand what I'm saying. If I use a lot of words that they have no clue to, I'm wasting my time and it's not fair to them. So my concern is when I talk to people who are on the front line, pro-life frontline warriors, about the use of the term abortion or euthanasia, I almost feel guilty, like I'm kicking these warriors. Because what I say to them is abortion is a meaningless word. We've had abortion legal for 50 years, and a lot of people don't understand the extent of it. And euthanasia is a meaningless word. And I've been kind of trying to nicely beg them to, yes, stop using nice words. It's not a nice subject. And yeah. I feel kind of like I'm kicking the warriors.
Yeah, Simone?
And it bothers me, but...
Okay, Simone, what do you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, we have to, I mean, those are the words, right? Like I think this is where we can just define our terms, right? Abortion is the murder of an innocent baby, right? It's a direct and intentional killing, which is murder, right? So I don't know if you're going to win the battle of like getting everybody to change their vocabulary less, you know, their vocabulary in this culture. But I agree with you. It's same with euthanasia, you know, and euthanasia even more horrifying, you know, calling it a mercy killing, because it's really not merciful to murder someone, even if, again, this goes back to never do evil, that basic moral theological principle I mentioned at the beginning of the hour, which is that, you know, the people who want, you know, are advocating for euthanasia, they're often, their intentions are good intentions, right? They want to relieve the suffering of a sick person. That's a good intention, but good intentions don't make evil actions good, right? Yeah. So, yeah.
Tony, I'm going to leave it there because I'm realizing we're coming near the end of the hour and there are still a bunch of people with questions. Let's go to Rick in Dallas, Texas, listening on 9:10 a.m. Rick, please go ahead with your question for Simone Riscala.
Thank you, Ms. Riscala. The question is about your mention of objective morality earlier. In conversation with the relativists, when I get to the, at least getting them to see something in the view of objective morality, I then mentioned that that essentially comes from God, and that becomes the kind of the separation. They then start telling me I'm just pushing my religion on them. What makes the Christian viewpoint any different than a Muslim viewpoint or Islam viewpoint if objective morality comes from a God? How do you deal with that type of situation?
Well, what I used to do in college is say, so do you believe in moral absolutes? And then they would say no, and I'd say, okay, do you believe that absolutely?
Oh.
You know?
Tricked him.
You know, I mean, this is where we've like lost all common sense reason. The very fact that we're having an argument about whether something's true or not is itself a proof, right? Like if you can make the state, if you can make the claim that truth is relative, that's an absolute statement, right? So I don't know what to do about the logic problem, but it's a problem of logic, right? I think that's where kind of charm and humor and just saying, do you believe in moral absolutes? You know, they're gonna say no and say, do you believe that absolutely? Right? I mean, just getting them to see how silly relativism is and that it doesn't work in their real life. Now, if you want to be less kind of snarky like I am, you can just say, hey, want to read chapter one of Lewis's, you know, chapter on the natural law from Mere Christianity. I want to read it with you and see what you think, you know, or has anything happened to you in your life that you could say that was wrong, like truly wrong objectively, not just in your experience, but like, is there anything that happens in the world that you can say is always and everywhere wrong? Right? You don't need God. You don't need God for that. I mean, yes, ultimately you need God because where does the criteria come from is God. But on a very down to earth level, you know, can you make any claim whatsoever? Right?
Rick, that help you, Rick?
Well, I like that you mentioned natural law. Is that the best place to start before getting to God, is getting them to see an agreement that there is something objective in nature, and that would eventually lead to a conversation about God as the supreme creator of nature?
Yeah, I think the natural law is a really, really great starting point. And also I recommend to you C.S. Lewis's book, The Abolition of Man, because it's not just pushing Christianity, but like, you know, there's... Every kind of religious system has a claim. Now we might, like as Lewis says, disagree about the particularities. What does he say, Lewis? He says, you know, you might disagree if you can have one wife or four, but nobody ever thinks you should have any woman you want, right? So, you know, we might disagree about the particularities of the moral code, but every religion has made a claim and a stake to it.
I'm very struck by the question, and I appreciate it, Rick, because when you talk about it, Simone, and you say that, well, there's a logical problem at the root of this. There is no logical way to justify an absolutist relativism. But nonetheless, we do. And I suppose that is a sign of damage, that something has been harmed in us. I really do think people in the modern world, whether because we've been exposed to so much, you know, media, and we're so cut off from just the natural world and from each other. But that's a sign of something very, very wrong when we can't say that we're not willing to say, or we even think it's backwards and wrong to say, some things are wrong always and everywhere.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we need healing. Like, our world needs healing, because the thing's never about the thing. So yes, the logical problem is there, but I, you know, for a lot of my students, you know, it's not that they were, and I think I said this before, maybe on the last show, it's not that they were like always stubborn about the gospel, right? Which is much more demanding than just admitting that there is objective truth, right? There's a lot to the Catholic thing, but you know, a lot of times their hearts are really broken. There's a lot of guilt. There's a lot of shame. So like, what's going on?
Yeah.
You know, because it takes a certain level of healing for someone to say, whether I follow the moral law or not, I know that there are things that are right and wrong. And I can kind of live in the freedom of knowing that, because ultimately it's not up to me. Right. So yeah.
What do you think, Rick?
Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate that. I want to circle back to the beginning, because you, one of the things that you said early on is that we, the fact that we don't have, and we don't teach, and people don't know basic moral theology makes it very difficult to have these conversations. So maybe you could review for us some of the things that you would want people to know about what the church, I mean, church has 2,000 years of reflecting on the words of Jesus and on the natural law. What would you want people to know about the moral life, about doing moral theology in this post-Christian world?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would want them to know is like who they are, right? That because all of morality is ordered to a relationship, which means you have to understand yourself. So I think Christian anthropology, the four powers of the human soul, right? There are four powers of the human soul. That's a fact. What are they? I mean, I love teaching on that. And then what are the virtues, namely the cardinal virtues, that perfect those four powers? It's really cool to know your powers, your human
yes.
powers. You know, that's really cool. And then that morality is about like being a kind of a person, right? It's not about avoiding this or that. Sure, that's a result of being a kind of person. But the beauty of like forming yourself to be the sort of creature that not only is in the habit of doing good, but enjoys it. That's the heart of virtue, is that you enjoy the good, right? So I think those are the most exciting things. And then just how do you judge the moral quality of an action, right? Look at the object, look at the intention, look at the circumstances. I think that's very fun. One of my most fun things to do is to teach on, related to the sources of morality, is the principle of double effect. When you have a moral dilemma where there's both a good and evil effect, how do you know if that action can be taken? It's really fun to analyze movie clips and you know, with students, other high schoolers or adults that I teach, and just say, okay, we're going to play this scene from The Last of the Mohicans, right? Tell me, does it pass the principle of double effect? Can that action be taken? You know, that's fun. That's really
Is that the
fun.
One where the guy goes over the side of the mountain?
I play the clip where character shoots Daniel Day-Lewis when he's burning at the stake. Can you shoot somebody while they're burning at the stake?
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Simone Ruscala, thank you so much. It's just such a great pleasure to have you here. I know you're very busy, but I think you're a great benefit to us and to all of our listeners. I hope you'll do this more with us.
I would love to. Thank you, Cy. You're great.
Okay. So check out, let's go back. No, never mind. So check out endowgroups.org.
Dot org.
endowgroups.org. All right. You really will be happy that you did check out endowgroups.org and find out about studying with other women, the documents of the Catholic Church. Up next is Steve Weidenkopf, and we're going to talk about the Crusades. What a great day to close a Friday afternoon talking about the Crusades. Is it something we should just hang our heads in shame about? We'll ask that of Steve Weidenkopf right after this on Catholic Answers Live.